You are listening to the Mission Matters Podcast Network, where we amplify the stories of entrepreneurs, executives, and experts.
Welcome to The Hiring Line. I'm your host, Scott Sheeran. Very happy to reconnect with an old friend today, Chad Sowash. Chad, how are you?
Excellent, man. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, brother. So Chad and I intersected, I think, strangely, like 10 years ago. It seems weird that that was
wow, that like long. 10
years, right? 2012, wasn't it?
Whew. Yeah, yeah. No. I think you're spot on that. Time, especially with pandemics, goes very fast.
Yep. It's weird, man, especially because we both have kids and the kids are grown up and you're just like, what in the hell? But yeah, so that was Sara Lee went out of business back in 2012 and I found myself coming back home to Cincinnati because, you know, we were expecting our youngest, who's 10 now, and just turned 10 in California last week. So, yeah, he had his 10th birthday at Disneyland. So
good for him.
I know. It was, you know, all planned by my planning wife. She puts all this stuff together and it's beautiful. And I just get to experience it, you know, and I don't take her for granted. So, yeah, we came back to Cincinnati and I rejoined an old Marine friend of mine, Drew Myers, with his company, Recruit Military. And I think you and I both started there almost at the exact same time, didn't we?
Yeah. It was very close.
Yeah. So we both came in as executives on that team for a short amount of time until Drew sold the company right after we both joined, which was,
you know, right out from under us. Yes.
I know. I was like, what the hell, man? But that's okay. Cause that's how this company that I run right now got started. We're the technically, legally, the former recruiting division of Recruit Military.
Yeah.
As we divested out of that organization, became a standalone. And now, of course, I've got a lot of other things going on besides just that. And you do too. So I definitely want to kind of get into you and your journey and how you found yourself where you are today, because I'm sure it's not what you thought it would be when you were transitioning out of the Army all those years ago.
Right? Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, completing school, I hated school. Going through high school, hated school, you know, seems like we are taught a one way to learn things, right? And many of us, you know, the complexity of the brain, there were so many different ways. And I was more of a visual learner and didn't always get an opportunity to work with teachers that taught in that way. Either way, no excuses. I sucked at school. So the last thing that I wanted to do was go to another 4 years of school. So I looked at the military. Not to mention, I wanted to get the hell out of Mansfield, Ohio, for goodness sakes. I mean, nothing with Mansfield other than I just didn't like, I just had to get out.
So boring, right?
Six days after graduation, I found myself in basic, you know, so graduated high school, graduated basics, Fort Dix, New Jersey, went to AIT at Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. So graduated there and was sent directly to Panama, where I found myself dug into a hillside getting, you know, AK-47 and mortar fire. But that didn't last long, which was nice.
Yeah.
And got to enjoy the beaches and the food and the women of Central America. So that was not bad. Sent me to but going from the beauty of Panama to Pine Bluff Arsenal in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, which is pretty much where all the nerve agent, I wouldn't say all of it, but a good amount of the nerve agent was and or is stored. Then I left in 93. I told myself I would never go back into the military. And then probably about 3 months after getting back into the civilian life, I just needed it. That regiment, that camaraderie, because, you know, nobody talks about the difference between corporate life and the military life. The military focuses literally on the team, because if the team doesn't succeed, then, you know, unfortunately on the battlefield, it's not going to turn out well. There's obviously death and destruction that happens there. Versus, you know, climbing the corporate ladder, which is all individualist. You know, it's all how do I take this on my back so that I can get promoted, as opposed to, you know, worry about myself, the rest of the team, so on and so forth. So I needed that structure and that camaraderie. I was in corporate life. I then found myself about a couple of years later, redesignating and going to school for infantry, which you never see. Usually you see people
start out in infantry.
Leave the infantry. Now there was a reason why. There was a reserve unit that was close to me that was a drill sergeant unit. And I had never heard of that ever. So I thought, I want to go do that. If I want to do something leading, teaching, this would be a great opportunity for me to, you know, to learn myself, but also to give back, because, you know, I was one of those dumb kids coming out of high school who really needed guidance. So went through infantry school, went through drill sergeant school. Next thing you know, I'm a quote unquote part-time drill sergeant until war happens. We all know what happens then. All the infantry gets sent to the battlefield, and then we are then sent and activated as drill sergeants down at Fort Benning, Georgia. So I spent in total 2.5 years on Sand Hill as a drill sergeant full time. And I had left my position as a vice president of an organization for that time frame. Luckily, coming back, you know, I was received with open arms. Right. But that in itself was another kind of like distinction between learning the military way versus the civilian way, right? And, and really, it's really interesting. And from the main point, most people think the military is incredibly rigid. And it is from a training standpoint, but it's not from an actual practical viability standpoint. So if you learn how to, you know, fix an engine or flank an element, well, you can't always do it the same way. You have to be fluid in your thought in how you actually either fix yourself on an engine or a position. Sure. And the terrain dictates as opposed to the actual 7-8, right? So, you know, there are so many things that I was able to learn from the military to be more fluid in thinking. And that revolved around troubleshooting and problem solving. And those are some of the, I would say, probably the two biggest needs in business and in corporate America today. But those are things that are not taught.
Right. And I bet your most challenging troubleshooting role was probably your role as a drill instructor.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. It's very challenging. Very, very challenging. Not to mention you have to find a different persona. I couldn't be Chad, the VP I had to go into what we called as drill sergeants on the Hill, at least my company, we called God mode. I mean, you did nothing wrong. You had to be the best. You had to be the strongest. You had to be the fastest. I mean, we went to fight schools. I mean, we had to be the best in everything that we did because we were training those kids slash men to be on the battlefield within months.
Right.
And if we didn't do that to our best ability, then, you know, the worst thing could actually happen to them and the people that were to their left and right.
Totally. And that's why I said troubleshooting, because you've got all these kids coming through there and each one of them has a viable path towards success through the end of training. And it's on you, you know, to try to dig in and troubleshoot and figure out what does this kid need, you know, to push them forward? You know, is it a kick in the ass or is it an actual, let's break down the barrier and have an actual conversation. Oh, wow, this drill sergeant is an actual human being, you know? And I had a couple of conversations like that with my drill instructors. And maybe they realized that I'm not the one who needs to be punched in the face, that I actually need to have a conversation. Maybe they did, you know?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to look my drill instructors up. Now, and they probably don't remember me. I mean, you know, it's such a short amount of time, but
and you never know. I mean, I have old trainees look me up all the time, and as a matter of fact, friends on Facebook and whatnot. And it's funny because the way they actually approach you, hey, drill sergeant, it's 205, which is what I know them as, right? Or 215 or whatever it is.
Right, right.
And, you know, I hope you don't mind that I've actually reached out to you. And I've actually created relationships and friendships because those kids are now men. You know, they were men before they left me, but they are now men who have families, who have experiences. And to me, to be able to understand not really how I impacted them, but how the experience impacted them.
Right.
And just to hear their stories is always, always amazing. And it's something that as a drill sergeant, you're doing it at that time. And I'll tell you right now, I would never go back and be a drill sergeant in Sand Hill again. That job just sucked. But to be able to have said that you did it, and I've been through, you know, obviously, you know, infantry basic training more than 10 times. I wouldn't do it again, but I would never trade that experience for anything.
100%. Totally agree. Yeah. And I know I've talked to you about that before, that I don't feel like I was cut out from a personality standpoint to have been a drill instructor. I never tried to do that, you know, but mad respect for those people that do, you know. And then, I mean, I can barely yell at my dog when it, you know what I'm saying? But I do sometimes, but, you know, it's hard. I feel bad right away and I give it a hug.
You know? It's funny because you know, even my team members and people that I would meet, you know, being a vice president, they would say, wow, you don't seem that type.
Right.
Right. You don't seem to be that overbearing, that type. I'm like, well, you don't know that persona. And that's, you know, that's by design.
Exactly. Right?
Yes, it is interesting. But again, just to be able to understand and take a look at how the military trains and how you can absorb so much information, because we go to so many schools. Mm-hmm. And civilians don't realize that either. Not just schools, but leadership schools. Every time you get promoted, you have to go to a leadership school or you can't retain that rank. You get demoted,
right?
So in the civilian world, again, they don't have to go through leadership school when they're promoted. They're just a manager.
Right. Figure it out. Right.
Yeah. Is not always the best way to go about things.
No. And I published a chapter of a book a couple of months ago. And the focus of that chapter was on that military transition, you know, from the military life to civilian life. I kind of get into that a little bit in that chapter. It's only a chapter, so I don't have much room to talk about a whole lot, you know, but I go into that leadership development and the training aspect a little bit in there. You might like that if it's out there somewhere. But
of course.
So how did, you know, I know I've said this probably to you in the past in conversation before, but before I found my, actually it was Drew Myers who recruited me into a company called Tech Systems, which was the large IT staff augmentation company. And before that was 2004. And before that, I didn't even know that recruiting was a profession. I didn't know that this was something that people did for a living. So how did you find your way into this world of talent and talent acquisition and recruiting?
It's funny because I actually just wrote a foreword to a book with this story. And I was in radio. I was actually doing advertising and sales for radio back when you actually listened to local radio, not Sirius or Spotify or whatever.
right.
Which is probably where you're finding this podcast. But I actually was called on the phone early in the morning. It was before 7 o'clock, and obviously no business hours are at 8. And I was called by a recruiter. Actually, they called the front desk and they asked for somebody in sales. Well, I was the only one there in sales. And again, this is kind of like my militaristic, you know, way of doing business. I was always there early, prepping, getting ready for my day, that kind of thing. When, you know, everybody else just kind of rolled in when they did. And that was fine. They were doing their process when they did their process. But anyway, this recruiter was looking for somebody, I guess, like me, who had that early bird kind of gets the worm motivation, who knows, picked up the phone. At that point, I was actually on the internet, and this is 1998. I was on the internet. I was doing some searches, and I was having some chats with some friends actually in Australia, and picked up the phone, and the recruiter said, hi, I can't remember his name, but are you familiar with the World Wide Web? I'm like, yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm on it right now. What do you want me to look up? And it was Online Career Center, which was a e-recruitment platform. That's how we used to call it, job boards,
right.
E-recruitment platform. And I said, wow, this is pretty interesting. It was in Indianapolis, which is where I was working at the time. And that launched me into an entirely different industry, selling for what became Monster.com. Mm-hmm. And then I've stayed in the industry ever since. I love the idea of connecting people and helping people find that next job or that next career, just something better than they're in right now. And the grass isn't always greener, but you know what? Sometimes it is.
Agreed.
Yeah. So that's where I started and I stayed. My next position, really, I found myself in a leadership position and I just kind of like cascaded from there until I was a VP of a much larger organization that worked with the major Fortune 500 companies in technology and systems, and then also the federal government, state government. So I had my hands in a lot of different things. I wasn't really feeling, was there for 10 years as a VP. I wasn't feeling much traction in going in anywhere else. It was a smaller organization. So that's when I met up with Drew and he said, hey, how would you like to come over and, you know, help us lead recruit military? I was there for a year, 6 months until it was acquired, with help the new CEO through transition, gave him away, you know, a wave. And I know then I was gone.
Right.
Then I found myself at the world's largest staffing organization, Randstad. I was in their RPO, recruitment process outsourcing division, where I created their very first veteran talent pipeline program and worked with companies like Ford in building pipelines so that we were driving veterans into their organization. Always loved obviously the veteran side of the house, but there was more opportunity in talking just about pure based tech. So when I left there after a couple of years, actually started off a consultancy, then started off a podcast just to be able to help, you know, with the awareness, name awareness, brand, those types of things. That took off. The consultancy took off, but the podcast just exploded.
Right.
And that's what I'm doing full time today. So when I'm not on the mic with you, I'm on the mic somewhere in the world on a stage or doing a podcast with the Chad and Cheese podcast, HR's most dangerous podcast.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And it's a, you know, I've been approached several times over the last decade of, friends and colleagues and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, you know, hey, man, you should get into podcasting. And I've always, you know, kind of had that hard, like, no, because I just think of Joe Rogan, you know what I mean? Or something that. And it's like, look, I just don't want to sit around and talk about politics all day. And, you know, that saps me of energy, you know, and it's like, I don't want to spend my life doing that. And yeah, I love talking. I love meeting people. I have interesting conversations with almost everybody that I have a conversation with. Every now and then you'll meet a really obscure engineer where as hard as you might try, you just can't pull anything out of them at all, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm a pretty disarming guy, but I've always pushed against it. And it wasn't until now where I saw this connection between, you know, I could talk about something that's not current events or politically related or something like that. Something that's business focused, something that's productive in my opinion. Because I don't really think it's that productive for everybody to sit around and argue about Republicanism and Democrats. You know what I mean? I just don't think it's all that productive. So and I'm not really with either camp, as you probably know. So So this I saw, to your point, was and we have a startup. I've mentioned it in several other podcasts, you know, and that's Climb with a K, and that's an AI enabled recruitment, advertising, and employer branding platform. So something to go up against those tools that are currently popular in the market right now that I think could be so much more effective in making those connections for people, because that's something that drives me, that I'm passionate about as well. And so I really saw this as an opportunity to maybe, you know, market that new tool, have some productive conversations, and really, you know, bring some awareness and do something positive and productive with my time. You know? So I love hearing about, you know, what you guys have done. And I've listened to several of your episodes over the years, you know. And
thank you.
Oh, of course. And we'll see where it goes, man. I mean, I can learn a lot from you for sure, you know? So how do you guys go about even finding who to talk to, or where do you always have guests on every single episode?
Not every single episode. We have once a week, our Friday show is just Joel and I, who's Cheese, Joel Cheeseman. So Chad and Cheese. And we do pretty much like a wrap up of what happened that week in news and funding and in acquisitions and those types of things. So we do that once a week, but we usually come out with about three podcasts a week, sometimes four, depending on what's happening.
Right.
We're now, I mean, we're over 900 episodes. We've been doing it since 2017, March of 2017. Wow. And we are a content machine. It's been a blast. There's so much to talk about, though. I mean, we can't cover everything because there's so much happening in the industry right now.
True. That is absolutely true. So, and hopefully with any bit of luck, you know, we'll be one of those aspects pushing the industry. We still have, just been defiantly against funding. So we're still completely self-funded, which, as you know, kind of slows things up. And we've got an internal team of developers who I think are very talented. They're doing good things both on the back end and the front end. And we're trying to marry those two solutions as effectively as possible, you know, through API calls and data querying and all these things you're probably familiar with. And I honestly did not know that as I started this startup, that I would spend several months engaging and having discussions and debating the aspect of data querying. As I designed this tool in this startup, in my mind, that was never something that was ever going to be discussed, you know, because you don't know these things, you know, and it's
right.
I figured Google's been around forever. Like, we understand how to query data. You know what I mean? That's like not something that needs to be figured out.
Yeah.
But sure enough, there's a lot to unpack with everything.
Yeah. Well, depending on the data, I mean, because when Google came out with they actually spent millions of dollars on a Super Bowl ad to talk about their MOS or their MOC crosswalk, right? Mm-hmm. I had a friend over there that was actually leading the team. And I was like, what the hell are you guys doing? And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, your shit's broke and you're talking about it and spending money on these things, right? And they just didn't know what they didn't know. And today it's shut down because, you know, again, they do know how to query data, but this isn't, not all data is the same, right? Not all context for that data is the same, you know? So it's an entirely different discussion, which you are obviously finding out.
I'm learning right now. Yes. So it's like, so the, our guys, our developers, I'm sure that they knew we were always going to have these problems, and they're like knee deep in it. And I'm over here as the clueless founder, like, why are we still talking about this? Yeah. You know what I mean? It was like, when somebody comes in and puts in a search, like they should just get what they want to see, you know? And you don't really realize all that goes into that specific things. So we're trying to lean obviously on a lot of third-party tools, stuff, technology that's already developed, because where we're not innovating in the market, we don't necessarily need to invest a lot of energy into innovating. So if it's already done and we can add on this package here and self-fund there, that's fine. We're trying to do that as much as we can. So
yeah, any open APIs you can dip into, do it. Mm-hmm.
Yep, exactly. So we're doing a lot of that. So yeah, so right now, man, we're trying to debate when and where we start developing out on the cloud, like whether it's, you know, Google or Amazon.
Yep.
So right now we've just been developing and testing on a server in my basement, you know, that these guys patch into, you know, and everybody works in there. And and that's fine for testing and development, you know.
Of course. Yeah. It's
perfectly fine. And we don't have to worry about runaway data costs, you know, through Amazon or anything else, because we're scraping a mountain of data, as I'm sure you know, on a nightly basis, you know, out there aggregating job listings, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Millions of them, you know, so, so it's all good, man. But so what are you hearing now? Obviously, you know, the market's been disrupted, you know, from a talent standpoint. So, I mean, and I know you're not working currently as a VP or as a hiring manager for a large company or anything like that. But I mean, what are you seeing right now from a trend standpoint with respect to available candidates, the market as a whole? I can tell you what I'm seeing. It's been tough.
You know? Yeah.
But what are you hearing on your end?
Yeah. So, you know, what happened during the pandemic has been a disruption because, go figure, pandemic, number one. And also we started to, not we, but I guess the actual essential workers have never been labeled as essential before in their life. And to be quite frank, they weren't making essential worker wages. So when you take a look at some of the supply chain issues that we've had, some of the staffing issues that we've had, a lot of it comes down to 40 years of trickle-down economics. You know, we haven't had to pay people more, so we just didn't, right? Even though that it wasn't a living wage. Now individuals are starting to see their worth, number one. Number two, we've been telling people that they couldn't work from home forever. And then a pandemic happens. And what happens? Everybody other than essential workers who are working, you know, working on site because they have to, everybody else is working from home. And we're starting to evolve and we're starting to find these different ways where we can actually have time with our kids. Sure. Where we can actually, right? So we don't have to have 2 hours on the road during a commute or on the train during a commute. So all of these things, we start to realize what life could be. And then the next thing you know, we have companies saying, well, we're going to do hybrid, or we're going to pull you back in the office, or what have you, right? So there's really this layer of pandemic onion that we started to peel away and see, you know, what was real and what was not.
Mm-hmm.
Who were really essential when Kroger's CEO went from making $12 million a year to 22 during a pandemic?
Right.
What did he do different? Nothing. He could have been gone for a year and nobody would have noticed, right? Although all of those individuals who were making quote unquote minimum wage, they deserved more because they're the ones that are actually doing the work. So we're starting to see kind of like this awakening. Everybody calls it the great resignation. They didn't resign until they were awake. Now they're awake and they see what their worth is. They understand where they actually are in the organization. They're not on the bottom, because if they were on the bottom, they would leave. Everything would be okay. But that's not what happened. Shit started to break, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we start to see these new awakenings happening all over, even, you know, white collar, blue collar, it doesn't matter. So when it comes to disruption, that was really what started what we're seeing today, and trying to find individuals where people are like, no, I'm not going to I'm not going to work, quote unquote, 40 hours a week. What you're giving me to do are tasks. I will knock those tasks out, but you're not going to tell me how long those tasks take. If it takes me 20 hours, then I'm going to go surfing.
Right.
Doesn't matter, right? I've done my job. And to be able to be more, to have more autonomy and to be able to be more fluid is incredibly important, because I think, again, another thing that we found out in the pandemic is we only get one of these, right? Unless you believe in reincarnation, but we only get one of these. So, you know, do I want to spend it with my head down in the computer or at the factory working all of this time? Or do I actually want to enjoy it and spend time with my family? So
exactly, it's
been a lot of big change and awakening, I think, in America for the most part. Europe has already started. They've been there, but the U.S. we've needed a nudge, and the pandemic did it.
You know, as I think through this now, too, I mean, I could definitely foresee, can't make any predictions because I don't see the future. And it doesn't really matter whether you believe in reincarnation or not, because even if you're reincarnated, what you're going to get the next time, is it going to be anything like what you got right now? It's going to be
exactly.
So you really only get one of these regardless of your outlook or beliefs. So
yeah.
Especially now with the white collar type of class, the white collar workers, which now are so many of them are working from home. Some might be starting to go back a little bit or travel a little more, but I think you're going to see a whole new element of offshoring, even to a degree that's never existed in the past. Because now it's like, you know, if you can have this person working, you know, behind a camera and they can get this work done from home and on Zoom meetings, you don't mind a bit of an accent, you're going to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Just to the degree that offshoring has impacted things in the past, I think it's going to impact things even more in the future, which will put downward pressure on white collar prices, right? But then the positions that are then lacking and people are going to have to start paying more for are those hands-on blue collar roles where you can't do it remotely, right? You've got to somebody's got to be able to turn that wrench, to run that line, to troubleshoot that boiler. You know what I'm saying? Those are the roles that are going to start paying more because there's not enough people willing to do them. So then there's going to be upward pressure on prices of those roles and downward pressure on what we've traditionally interpreted as white collar roles, just through mechanisms of more exposure to more people willing to do it across the globe.
I think we've already seen that on the blue collar side, because what we did again back in the, I think it's like early to mid 90s, is we started doing away with vocational schools. And we had, right? We had plumbers, we had electricians, we had carpenters, we had all of the blue collar, you know, positions. They were filled coming out of high school, going directly into positions in our communities. Today, it's harder than hell to find a plumber.
It is.
You know, to find a carpenter when we wanted to actually do some work on the home. So those prices have gone up because of demand. Demand pretty much stayed the same, but there weren't as many individuals who were actually, you know, tooled for that, right? They weren't skilled for that. So we have that piece. And I think that was already going up as it is. From a white collar standpoint, I think that technology is moving so fast that a couple of things are going to happen. All of those companies who demand that their people come back into the office, which means they have a very small pool to actually recruit from, they're going to have issues, right? I don't care if they're developers, I don't care what they are, but they're going to have issues. Mm-hmm. The companies who say, hey, let's go ahead and get into a remote work scenario so that I can, here in Indianapolis, I can try to find salespeople or coders or what have you all over the United States. Right. Now, one of the things that's going to do, which I think is incredibly important for everybody to understand, is right now, an individual who codes in Indianapolis that used to go into an office was paid different than somebody in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Doing the exact same job.
Right.
Exact same job. And what we did as employers is we said, well, that's because of cost of living is lower. So therefore, we're going to adjust for cost of living. That is a narrative that has been total BS for decades, because the same work is being done. Right. So we take a look at equity and fairness, not just from a gender standpoint or, you know, an individual with color standpoint, but as a human doing the exact same work. Now, when you're doing that from a remote standpoint, you're going to be able to ask more, right? You're going to be able to, especially if you're that kid who's in Indiana who's coding versus the one who's in Silicon Valley, you're going to be able to ask more for that. And you're going to get much different trainings. It's going to be a conversation that I think definitely goes global as mm-hmm. we see Estonia, who is like the tech mecca of Europe, where they are just mm-hmm. killing it. So was Ukraine before Russia did, you know, what they did and started, you know, started this war with Russia. Right. But we're going to see new pockets of focus in different areas, whether it's developers, it doesn't matter, but we'll be able to tap into them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's and a lot of it too. You know, I don't necessarily, I totally see your point with respect to, you know, the corporate push and that narrative on cost of living, things like that. Completely see your point. But I also think that too, that the pressure of that is because that cost of living is lower, you get people aren't demanding as high of wages because, you know what I'm saying? They don't negotiate individually as strongly because they're like, I live in a $150,000 house. Well, not anymore. Right. But,
You know, transparency is going to change that though, because now states are demanding that salaries are put on jobs mm-hmm. and the government's going to demand, because here in the United States, we've never been transparent and we've always said, hey, don't tell your buddy what you're making, right? That's between you and me. That is all those walls are coming down. And the only reason why the women's soccer team is now getting paid as much as the men's soccer team is one reason, is because they knew they were being underpaid. As soon as everybody understands that they're being underpaid, it's none of your business what I pay for a house. It's none of your business what I pay for a loaf of bread. I'm doing the same job. As soon as those transparency, those walls come down and everything's transparent, that's when the market's going to change dramatically.
It could. But, you know, even you have to keep in mind, too, though, even though you might be doing the same job, you know, rates of income, rates of profit, rates of revenue are very different depending on the product that you're making. So, for instance, at Sara Lee, I was the head of recruiting for Sara Lee Bakery. And I can tell you from experience that every loaf of bread that we sold, we made about a cent and a half. That's it. That's it. Yeah. That's all we made. So, and why are profit margins so low on bread? Well, damn, man, it's because it's one of the oldest freaking industries in the world. And it's been competed over and innovated and pushed to its limit. Whereas if I would go, anytime I went out there and found like a really solid, awesome looking plant manager, and all of a sudden I saw that he was with a Gillette plant with Procter & Gamble making razors, I would not call that guy. Because I knew I'm not going to be able to afford that guy. And he's doing the same job. No, I didn't have a chance. And it was like, he's doing the same job managing a relatively similar operation, same amount of people. You know what I'm saying? I've got a 250-person industrial bakery, and he's got a 250-person whatever it is.
Yep.
But I totally recognize the idea that every time you buy a razor, a lot more money's being transferred than every time you buy a loaf of bread. Like I get that. So it's not that we were underpaying intentionally our plant managers, is just that there's honestly just not that much money being made. I would ask you that, what your thoughts are like on the women's soccer. I don't care what women's soccer players make. I really don't.
They do.
And of course they do. And they should. I care what I make. I care what I make, but I don't think that they should care what I make. What difference does it make? I don't care what the men's soccer team makes. Is the women's soccer team generating a similar amount of revenue as the men's soccer team?
They're generating more.
Well, then they should be making more.
But the whole premise was they wouldn't have known if the transparency didn't happen, right?
Gotcha.
And that's the biggest key, is that, do I need to know that a dude's making, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars? No, it kind of makes me mad and sad at the same time, right? Because his right toe was kissed by God. But when you take a look at, we talk about equity, when you have the female, the U.S. females, a women's soccer team winning, mm-hmm. right? And the men's don't, but they're getting paid more. So it's one of those things where we don't know unless we know, and we just didn't know. So transparency was the key there.
That's fair. And I hesitate with soccer because I'm wholly ignorant when it comes to soccer. And I know the soccer is like the biggest global sport that exists.
Well, let's take it down to today though, because we know that women get paid like 80 cents on the dollar for men. Now, if there was a transparency, and there's a million different reasons why that happens, because women mm-hmm. don't negotiate as much as men and all those, none of that matters. If they're doing the same job, negotiation shouldn't matter for a developer, right? They should be getting paid fairly. Now, if we did know that and it was transparent, then we wouldn't have this inequity that we've seen for hundreds of years.
Right. Right. No. And again, I have nothing. I'm not opposed to transparency in any way, shape or form. And you know where I come from a political standpoint. I'm just, I'm a hardcore individual rights. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and that's kind of that. That's where I land. But it's and like when you made that argument for soccer, that the only thing that I'm more familiar about was like women's basketball in America. You know, because they had that same argument with the women's basketball team. But at the same time, it's like there's like 300 people watching the women's basketball game. It's like, I'm sorry, and I'm not trying to say that your product's bad. I don't watch the men's team either. You know what I mean? I'm just don't really care. Yeah. But yeah, it's like, if you guys want to make money, you need to attract revenue. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, yeah.
And I guess if soccer is probably different. They probably do make more money than the men's team. They probably do.
Just because they're better.
Right. Well, exactly. They're putting a quality product on the field. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt about it at all, man. So yeah, I totally see that. The only place where I always, you know, tend to fall short is, you know, forceful regulation is where I start to get a little iffy. You know, I'm like, yeah. Just because I know sometimes where those variants lead. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and you take a look at, I mean, but the counter is there too, deregulation and trickle down economics was deregulation. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is we've seen a huge gap. I mean, we have no middle class nowadays because it's dwindled away. And you take a look at where the money's actually gone. It didn't trickle down. It stayed at the top, right? And that's the biggest issue is that, you know, we have to find a balance. Right. Of, you know, guardrails. How tight are the guardrails versus how wide they are? I don't like rules either, man. You know, but right. When it comes down to, I'm a white dude in America. I won the genetic lottery. Okay. That's all there is to it. Everybody else, though, from a fairness standpoint, what do we do to ensure that we are paying people fairly, we are treating them fairly, and, you know, we don't have these discriminatory issues that we've had over the years, whether it's pay, whether it's treatment, either way. That, sure, to me is the biggest key. And, you know, obviously I have two daughters and I want to see them get treated fairly as well.
Sure. Absolutely. And I only have one. So I only had to go through the
still
the teenage daughter years once as opposed to your twice. So
lucky, man.
I know. Hey, like I said, she's almost 22 and she's come back to us now. She's sweet.
Yes.
Again. She's sweet again. So, but, well, see, you know, you've been to, and there were a couple of years there though. I was like, oh dude, my God.
Yeah. Oh, I feel you. No, anybody who has a darling, you know, little girl, hug her as tight as you can, mm-hmm, right now, because as soon as the hormones hit, man, ooh, it is crazy. The boys, yeah, I think it's, they just turn more dumb, but that's okay.
I think what it is they try to, and I think I went through this too as a teenager, they try to feign apathy. Like they're too cool to care. The girls are on the other side and they're, you know, just like angry and hammering, you know, and I'm like, you're daddy's little girl. Like, why are you mad at me? You know?
What did I do?
Right. Yeah. Really? No. And then the guys are just like, whatever, you know.
Yeah. Which, yeah. Well,
yeah, and not to derail the conversation, but I mean, when I think back, you know, to my own experiences, and that's it's like when my dad told me that he was leaving my mom, and I was 12, I was around the cusp of teenagedom, and that's the exact card I played. I'm just like, yeah, okay, I don't care.
Yeah,
I'm not cared.
Of course,
you know what I mean, it's of like course. I look back at it now, but yeah, that was the path I played. So
yeah,
but anyway, no. So I mean, look, and it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I was talking to another guest about this too. It's like, bottom line, like all of us, you know, whether we come from the paradigm of the left paradigm or the right paradigm, we're like me, who's more of a, you know, anarchist libertarian type of paradigm. You know, we're all 95% similar. We have those same throughputs. You know, it's like we're all just trying to live as productive and comfortable an experience as possible and care for the families that we love and take care of the people around us to the greatest degree that we can. And then, you know, we're only all about 5% different if you really boil it down. And that's like social media, for instance. And I was just making this point earlier. It's like, I think social media conveniently marginalizes the 95% about which we're all similar.
And, oh, yeah.
And uniquely hones in on the 5% where we all see differently. And it's like,
that's where the clicks are.
Exactly.
That's where the clicks are. And that's the thing is that, you know, one of the things that the internet has been able to do is provide us scale to be able to do things that we can't do as humans. Humans don't scale well, right? You and I, we don't scale well. We can only do so much. We only have 24 hours in a day, so on and so forth.
Right.
Tech can scale. But one thing it can scale, and I don't think that we realized, or somebody incredibly evil and dark did realize, is that you can scale hate.
Okay.
And that in itself has turned, you know, obviously into a weapon, and one that, you know, again, not wanting regulations, but we have to do something to be able to curb that because, you know, it's, if you're looking at an employee base, you always want to try to pulse survey what's happening mm-hmm. in that employee base. As we take a look at a nation and we pulse survey it, it's either all the way to the right or all the way to the left. And that doesn't bring us together. And we need to be together.
It doesn't. It doesn't. It's your point earlier, too, about, you know, there's going to be some companies that respond well to the new norms in the market. And there's going to be other companies that don't. And I can tell I've got my own and my list of 53 clients that our company has. I've got some that are responding well and others that aren't, you know, and they're going to have the ability, the ones that respond well, you know, whether it's through remote work or whatever it is, training through apprenticeships or vocation, whatever it is, the ones who respond well are going to end up with the most talented folks.
Yes.
And the ones that end up with the most talented folks are going to win at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think today, much different than in the 80s when greed was good, we have to focus on what the people actually want, right? Mm-hmm. And their experience. Because again, if they're not happy, much like if you are a soldier on the battlefield and you're thinking about mama back home because you just had a fight, your focus is not going to be on the battle. It's the exact same thing with an employee who is thinking about everything other than their work, and what they should be passionate about. When you start to rip that passion away is when you have problems.
Engagement.
That's
the key, man. And that's I've had this conversation with several of my clients too, that focus so strongly on like personality tests, for instance, you know what I mean? And it's like, look, the key to whether or not the person you hire is successful, it has far more to do with what you do with them after you bring them on board and how you engage them than it does is whether or not you hire the right person.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying just hire anybody. I'm not saying that. Right. But at the same time, if you can key in on ways to get that person engaged and get them passionately engaged about what mm-hmm. you do, I mean, you're going to see a successful employee every single time.
I'll end on this because I got to jump.
No, I know you do. You do.
So leaving the military, coming into civilian life, I was given the chance in a sales position and I killed it. I was the number one sales guy in less than 3 months. And I went back to that sales manager later and I said, look, he was a district manager. I was like, why did you hire me? I had no sales skills. I just came directly out of the military, right? I had never had any experience around this at all. Why did you hire me? And he said, look, I knew that you came from the military. No, you didn't have any of those skills, but you did have discipline. I knew that you knew you were mission focused. I knew that you would show up on time mm-hmm. and I knew you would treat people with respect, the people that you work with and the people that you go out and you see on a daily basis. Right. Those are things that I could not teach you. What I could teach you were the sales things, right? So as you had said, there are moldable people that are out there that if you give them a chance and they are in at least, you know, where you think they should be from the standpoint of a character standpoint and you drive with them, definitely give them a chance.
100% agree. No doubt about it. So, and I know you got to run. So I know we're up against it. We could I could just sit and talk for hours, dude. So
I feel
and will anytime. Doesn't have to be recorded. I mean, just, you know,
you come to Cincinnati and have a beer. That's what I'm talking about.
Do it. Do you like stouts?
Oh, yes. Cincinnati has amazing beer, period. So I'm there.
Perfect. I'm a stout guy. So I always have some in the fridge. Come over anytime. So
excellent.
So Chad, hey, welcome back anytime, man. Love having you on. And I look forward to connecting again soon.
Sounds great, man. Take care.
All right, brother. Talk to you soon.
Later.
This has been a Mission Matters Network production. Listen to this show and browse our entire catalog by visiting missionmatters.com.